Another edition today. We welcome everybody to the show, and hope everybody's having a great Monday. I'm really pleased to have as my guest today Peter Bolton King. Peter, I don't know if you normally use all three of those names, but since they're the way they're written, that's the way I'm going to introduce you.
Kurt, they call me anything you want to. Normally people do. I answer to everything.
Peter is the Global Residential Director for RICS, Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, and I know our audience, Peter, is going to be interested to hear something about RICS because we know there's a presence here in the U.S. and quite a few people participate, and I don't know how many people understand how much we're parallel with each other from NSPS to RICS, and I know you guys have some pursuits that seem to go pretty far beyond what we do, so I know people are going to be interested in hearing about that as we move forward, but perhaps to begin the show, you could give our audience a bit of personal background about yourself.
Yeah, certainly, Kurt. First of all, thanks very much for asking me to take part. It was a pleasure to share what's going on around the world. I've been in the business now for, I'm afraid, something over 40 years. I started off as a lad working in a little firm and then a slightly bigger firm, and it covered a number of areas that you will know by slightly different names, but it was basically the appraisal side, it was the property inspection side, management, so all that side, residential and commercial. We then actually in 1987, the partnership, which by then included me, sold out to one of the big UK banks, where at the stage in the 1980s where they seemed to think it was a good idea to buy up all real estate agents. So that's what happened. Cutting forward, about 14 years ago, I became CEO of the one of the trade associations, for want of a better word, for the real estate side in the UK, and then about 3 years ago I moved to my current role within the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. As you said, Kurt, you know, there are some overlaps, and a lot of people may have heard of RICS, but they won't necessarily know what we do. Our members cover a massive wide church, actually. Really, if you think of anything to do with property, the development of it, the management of it, whether it be under the sea, on the land, the construction side, the infrastructure, our members, which are about 118,000 around the world, deal with all of those different things. So there is overlap, of course, especially on your side that your members deal with, but we also deal with a very big church, if you like, from that point of view. And what we're about is promoting and enforcing the highest professional qualifications and standards in those markets in order to bring confidence and consistency to the markets that we all serve.
And understanding that that's the role, am I correct in thinking that the Institute isn't responsible for actual licensing of professionals, but more related to qualifications and standards overall?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, that. I think people tend to forget, perhaps, that in the UK, and I'm generalizing here, but if you wanted, for instance, to be a real estate agent, whether that be on the sales side or the letting side or the management, despite what we think should happen, the government over here still don't agree that there should be a better regulation. Therefore, in effect, any idiot can set themselves up, open up their shop tomorrow with no qualifications, no experience, no insurance. And, of course, that leads to problems. So you are right. In effect, what we do is we self-regulate our members, but it's therefore all about setting the qualifications and then checking those standards and taking action against those standards with a standalone regulatory arm if anybody, unfortunately, falls foul of those. So, yes, you're right. It's self-regulatory, but that is common within our sector in the UK.
I see. And then for your worldwide members, obviously, I'll use the U.S. as an example. Here, of course, we are licensed on a state-by-state basis. We don't have any crossover, really, in licensure. So we have to obtain a license from any state in which we want to practice. So if your members here, obviously, being a member of your organization wouldn't affect our licensure here. But are there countries where that does have an impact on...
Yeah, no, you're right. No, it does. Yes, it does vary around the world. But we have various codes of practice, standards. Some of the people listening might have heard of a thing called the Red Book, which in effect is the guidance for our members as to how they should meet the International Valuation Standard Council agreement. And therefore, that they have to follow those things. If they don't follow those standards, if they don't follow the codes, the rules, the ethical standards we've got, which I know we're going to come on to in a little while, then we will take action against that and we will enforce against that. You are right. In some parts of the world, the RICS qualification is accepted by governments and by regulatory authorities as being a qualification that they understand and that is acceptable to them in order to gain your local license.
And of course, your members go way beyond what we refer to as the professional surveyors. So I guess the regulations or the guidance that you put forward covers a pretty broad spectrum, doesn't it?
They do. That's one of the issues, actually. I have to sit here thinking about all of the different areas that even within the sphere I deal with, which is residential, that covers the surveying side, it covers the valuation, the appraisal side, it covers the sales, lettings, management of properties, right the way through to actually the supply of homes and social housing and everything. And you're right, we have to produce, and we do produce, a wealth of guidance and technical notes for the members across, in fact, within the professional groups department, which I sit in, is actually 17 professional groups. So it's across all of those. And because we are a worldwide organization, of course, increasingly, we have to make absolutely certain that what we write is fit for purpose across the globe. And that has to take into account, obviously, local laws and regulations.
As a matter, I was glad you followed up with that, because that was kind of going to be my next question, was because of the international nature of the organization, I was going to ask what impact that might have overall. I mean, obviously, there are underlying principles that should at least apply regardless of where one is in practice, but knowing that different countries, ours being one, and even in our case, as I said, down to the state level, have somewhat different qualifications, although not dramatically different, I was going to assume that created some amount of challenge.
Yeah, it does, but of course we have got offices based around the world, and part of their role is to work with me and my colleagues to say, okay, well, you've got this central bit, which, as you say, Kurt, and it applies everywhere. There's certain mandatory things that everybody should do. Then you get some general guidance, but then there is country-specific or area-specific, or in this case of the USA, could well be state-specific guidance, because at the end of the day, the local laws obviously have to take precedence. So I mentioned this thing called the Red Book, which is the guide for carrying out appraisals, carrying out valuations. Now there is a version which, for instance, we published in Brazil earlier in this year, which has got the same central bit, if you like, the mandatory bit as everybody else, but then there's a wraparound which deals specifically with the Brazilian market. So we have to be very aware of that, and as I say, the local laws clearly have to rule. So we have to work alongside the local rules, but also local customs, which is another challenge, especially when you talk about ethics.
Do you have to have, I'm asking that improperly, because it sounds to me as though it's mandatory. I guess the question should have been, do you see it beneficial from an organizational perspective then to have some presence in each of the countries where you have members, so you have an office there that cover some sector, at least, of the overall spectrum of what you cover?
Yeah, Kurt, I think you've got to do that these days. We are a global organization. By the end of this decade, we reckon that there's a likelihood that we will actually have, for the first time, more members outside the UK than inside the UK. We've got some massive growth in membership going on in the likes of India, South America, Asia, and indeed, it is growing, as you said earlier, in North America as well. So what we can't do, and I think is absolutely wrong, is we can't sit here in London and say, oh, yeah, this is how you must do it, and you've got to do this, and you do what you're told. That is not the way, actually, to do these things. things. It's got to be a collaboration. You've got to actually have people on the ground who understand the local market and can be is talk and deal with people like me, who the object of my job is to give them guidance as to how they could actually move forward on various areas. But you know, I just don't believe this day and age you can sit here in London and tell people what to do. It just doesn't work. So we have these offices, a number of offices around the world, which are growing every year.
Yeah, I would say that on a more local level here, I'm a Virginian. Our state capital is Richmond. I would say that there's difficulty even sitting in Richmond trying to tell everybody what to do. So,
yeah.
I can't even imagine what it would be like on a worldwide basis, that's for sure. But so being obviously a broad-based organization that covers a lot of land-related activity, you guys still work pretty closely with folks like FIG on the surveying side, on the international side of things, right?
Absolutely. We have agreements, and we work alongside many organizations, as you say, FIG, BOMA, North America, as far as the work on the measurement standards. No, around the world, we work in conjunction, because at the end of the day, I tell you what, Kurt, many of the problems that we come across, I find when I talk to people around the world, they may be slight tweaks, but at the end of the day, a lot of these are the same issues, and the way to move forward in this increasingly globalized world is to collaborate, to get together, to not think of yourselves working as a competitor, but the fact that we're there to try and improve standards for the greater good of the members and, most importantly, the consumer as well. So, yeah, work in collaboration with these people.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. In my interactions with FIG as part of the representative group from NSPS, I found that to be true. I go to those meetings and talk with people from all over the world and find that our challenges are very, very similar, regardless of where we live, because we're all related to the same thing. We're all related to the land somehow, and land has a certain connotation in people's lives. So that's clearly true. Well, we're within our last minute of our first section, and we want to come back and talk about the international standards that we want to discuss today. So I won't jump into that subject just before we go to break, but I will tell you, we talked about the chartered part of things. I was doing some research recently. We always talk about the surveyors in the U.S. and who were the first surveyors and whatever, and I ran across something that I probably had seen in history books before about John Smith, who did some surveying in my home area of what became Virginia, and he was shown as a chartered surveyor. I didn't know if that had some connection to what eventually became RICS or not, but
let's have a chat. I've got some history here, and I forgot to tell you about that, yeah. So we'll be happy to tell you some dates when we come back.
We'll be right back. Thanks.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that Pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com, and thank you.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's schonstedt.com.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back today with Peter, and we really appreciate you being with us today, Peter. Again, as I said, and just before we went to break, we were chatting a little bit about my thoughts of John Smith and the surveying that he did here, I guess, early 1600s. But having read about him, the qualification registered for him was chartered surveyor. So that must go back a really long way in English history.
Yeah, just while we've been in the break, I was actually on Google just trying to work out, because I found a Captain John Smith, born in England, who then was a surveyor out in the USA, but may or may not be the same person. You're right. Yeah. I mean, the RICS originally, believe it or not, started, I think, really in about 1792 as a group. Wasn't called that then, but the modern era, the modern chart surveyor, came about in about 1868, where a group of surveyors got together, formed what then eventually became the Royal Institution, very cleverly bought a property right slap bang in Westminster. For those of your listeners who know London, I can go up onto our roof and look over Westminster Abbey and the Houses of Parliament and everything else. So they were a bit cute then. They bought a very good bit of real estate right in the centre of London. But the other interesting thing, just to finish on the history, Kurt, is that we're slightly different. I mentioned before that my previous role was a CEO of a trade organization. At the RICS, we are governed by this Royal Charter. And the Royal Charter says right at the top of it that our first and foremost interest, it has to be in the public interest, which means, as you can imagine, that there are times when government propose something that is absolutely the right thing as far as the public interest is concerned, but actually may not be in our members' interest because it costs them money or whatever. But at the end of the day, the public interest has to come first. And that actually works in our favour because the government know that, the Bank of England know that, the media know that, and they know if they come to us, we've got to tell them as it is. We can't in any shape or form twist it just because that's what our members want to hear. So it's interesting. It's a slightly different organisation to a straightforward, if you like, trade organisation.
Right. And honestly, that's pretty close to what we are as NSPS as well. We're a professional organization, not a trade organization. And obviously part of our mission is to work with our members as they adhere to their state regulations and in some cases federal regulations. But in the interest of protecting, our terminology typically is interest in protecting the public health, safety, and welfare. So when we get a license here, we're mandated to do that, not necessarily to perform our work in a way that's beneficial just to our client if the evidence leads in a different direction. So
absolutely. It's very similar.
And that way it's pretty similar. And when you and I first started talking about the international ethics standards, and I was fortunate enough to be able to join the team that's working on that, you might want to give a little background about how that began and maybe even how it ties back to the property measurement standard that's also kind of going on at this same time.
Yeah, sure, Kurt. There's a little bit of history on this. We talked already today about the fact that if you've got standards in there, then it increases public confidence, and that's got to be the way to go. And there have been standards in our profession around for some time, and not just in our profession. If you think of it, there's a thing called the International Financial Reporting Standards. Now, that in effect is, I think, over 120 countries actually insist that accounts for companies are produced in a certain way and they follow this financial reporting standard. So that's been around for some time. And we also mentioned this Red Book, the valuation standard, if you like, and that again has been around for some time in the form of the International Valuation Standards Council. So if you have got valuing property sorted, and you know how you should be reporting that valuation in the company accounts. What then happened was about the beginning, the tail end of the year before last, in fact, we started talking to a number of organizations who were saying, you know what, there's something funny out here, because there may be agreement as to how you actually value property, and there may be agreements to how you report that valuation in the financial accounts, but there's no standardization as to how you actually physically measure the property. And by that, I'm not talking about whether you value it in feet, meters, dollars, pounds, bananas, whatever. It's actually physically, how do you work out the gross external, the gross internal, the net internal? And in fact, some independent research, and I know you've seen, Kurt, showed that depending on which of the main five or six measurement standards you use around the world, if you take a single floor, standard floor of, an office block, and depending which way you measure it, it can actually make up to 20% difference. So as you can imagine, if you're an international investor, and of course this day and age, there's no such thing really as just the local market, because we all are increasingly dealing with people from around the world from an international global point of view, and they start to think, well, hang on a minute, are you telling me that if I'm looking at something which calls itself, I don't know, 10,000 square feet in Sydney, that that is not the same 10,000 square feet for an identical property in New York or London, Johannesburg, Tokyo, wherever? And as I say, make 20% difference. So the thought was, okay, well, this is a bit silly, this. That's not to say that there's anything wrong with the way you measure it locally, but surely we should have a go at trying to agree an international property measurement standard so that those who are dealing with international clients could actually measure a property not only along the local way of doing it, but also under the any agreed international standards, so that at least that global client knows that 10,000 square feet is 10,000 square feet, regardless of where they're looking. So in May last year, a group of organizations, including your own, got together in Washington under the auspices of the World Bank, because they got this. They realized that there need to be some consistency. And cutting a long story short, a year later, just over a year, they managed to come up with an agreed standard as to how you go about measuring offices. And they're now going to start work on residential property and then move on to the other types of property that we all deal with. And if anybody's interested in having a look at that, it's a very simple website. It's International Property Measurement Standards Coalition, IPMSC.org, and that will give you all the information, including you could download this new idea as to how you measure international property. So that's how the measurement standards came about, and there's currently now, I think, 58 professional bodies around the world who have signed up to the coalition, and way over 100 companies and organizations such as government departments who have signed up to that as well. What then happened, and then I'll shut up and let you talk again, Kurt, was that those same people started saying, well, fine, so we've got the reporting standards, we've got the valuation standards, we've got the measurement standards coming in now, but surely all of this should be done in an ethical way. And that's a no-brainer. Of course it should. But one of the problems we have is that the RICS and your own organization and many, many others all have their own different code of ethics. There is no standardization or attempt to standardize from a global point of view, and that's where we came into it. And as you know, 16 of organizations met in this time at the United Nations in New York in October to start the process of saying, okay, should we be looking to try and come up with some high level principles which cover code of ethics?
Yeah, and it's been very interesting to become involved with that. And I think it's important, as you pointed out, to recognize that this is a standard to which one aspires, and it isn't intended really to supersede what somebody else is doing. What a kind of a parallel I was thinking about when you were talking about how this all came about and the idea of uniform standards, something that I think will bring that home to our U.S. listeners here a little bit, is our national standard developed by American Land Title Association and our organization for conducting surveys in a particular manner, and that came about for a very, very similar reason, because when the funding for building things began to be more nationally focused than locally focused, then you needed a way for the people in California, for example, to feel comfortable when they're financing something in Virginia, that the survey is going to have the same overall characteristics and standards as what they were accustomed to. And that was really the impetus for that. And so perhaps in a smaller way, we could liken what we've done with the ALTA ACSM standards to what you're talking about as being more broad brush, and while at the same time respecting local laws and standards.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right on that, because if you go back to the situation that you had clearly before you then agreed a common set of standards for the surveys, there no doubt the various states had codes, and there was no doubt quite a lot of overlap. But the problem is, I'm going to guess, because it certainly is the case with ethics, that because of that overlap, they're not understood consistently by members of the public and the clients and the consumers and that professional service, and therefore that understanding is poor. I think that would have led to confusion. It could also, dare I say, impact on the actual legitimacy of us professionals in an increasing global and interconnected marketplace. I was reading a report that's just come out, actually, by an international business organization, and I'm afraid they were still saying that, you know, following the financial crash and everything else, you know, it doesn't matter what you are as a professional, the public's trust of professionals is not too good still. So, you know, anything we can do to increase that global transparency has to be the right thing to do. And I think, you know, establishing this common ethics standard, whilst it's not replacing what you've already got there at the moment, it's got to enhance transparency, consistency, and that trust in the services that we're all offering. So I think that's where we're coming from.
Yeah, it makes one wonder, I guess, because we tend to look back in history and particularly on the surveying side here in the U.S., and to the stature, if you will, that professional surveyors have enjoyed over time, and then we look at sometimes where we are today, and perhaps we don't think, at least, there is as well, or we are as well respected as we think we ought to be. So I guess this whole idea of recapturing, if you will, that sense of pride and uniformity, so that people are able to say, okay, this is to what my individual doing my work should aspire, and if they're not meeting that, then I have some reason to think that perhaps they're not doing what they should do. So I sort of see a parallel with that, and I also see that we're about 25 seconds away from our next break. So let me just end this break with saying, when we come back, perhaps we can pick up on where things stand now with the ethics standards group and how many people are involved and what has happened up until this time. Because for me, it seems it's gone quickly, but maybe not as quickly for some of the people who have been involved before. So let's go to the next break, and we'll be right back.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details. Or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's schonstedt.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
For our regular listeners, you will know that this is the time in our show where our sponsor, Parker Davis Quick Stakes, sponsors our contest every week, and I pose a question to my guest, and the first person to provide whatever the answer is back to Quick Stakes Contest at AmericasWebRadio.com is our winner for the week. So I'm going to hopefully make this simple for our listeners, Peter, and just ask you to state again what the initials RICS stand for.
Will do, Kurt. And everybody pay attention, please, because Kurt got it wrong earlier. Not that I'm going to moan. It is the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors.
Institution. Remember that. I did get it wrong.
Uh-huh.
So the proper answer is Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. Thank you so much for that, Peter. When we left in our last segment, we were talking about this whole idea of the international ethical standards and why that's important. And so you may want to follow up with that a bit, but if you could give us a report on where things stand at this point, how many countries or entities are involved, and where we're going.
Yeah, sure. I've actually been absolutely delighted with the initial take-up on this. We met in, as I say, in New York back at the tail end of October, and we gave people until the end of November to register their interest if they wanted to be, for want of a better word, a foundation member. I'm looking at the list in front of me at the moment, actually. We currently have 33 declarations, signed declarations in. That's one more than you know about, Kurt, because we've actually just had another one in from China, which is interesting. And it really does cover many areas of the world. Now, these are all non-profit-making organizations. So these aren't companies. They are our organizations like our own, like both of ours. What I think is also fascinating is that we are getting approached and getting expressions of interest from organizations who, for whatever reason, have not taken part in those international property measurement standards that we were talking about before the break. And an example there being, Royal Architectural Institute of Canada, the Royal Institute of British Architects, and I'm hoping that we get an email very shortly from the American Architects, Institute of American Architects, confirming their interest. So we've got that, and we've also already got places like the Dubai government and a major department within the UK government who are saying, we get this, we support this, we want to be supporters. And although those government departments can't be formal coalition members, it's great to have them on board as you'd like, supporting partners. So at this stage, 35, I've made a bet in my little brain as to what we will be by the time we hopefully launch the first draft standard for the world to have a look at and comment on. So what was happening from now is that we're just going through the legal process of formally setting up the coalition. That should be sorted out within the next a few weeks, ignoring Christmas, the bylaws and that sort of thing. And then it's agreed that we will set up an independent standard settings committee who will be formed from hopefully experts in the field of ethics to come up with these suggestions as to high-level ethical principles. That would then be formed into a draft, hopefully by the latest this time next year, to, as I say, to get out for worldwide consultation. So everybody will have an opportunity for making comment and helping to put together the final version, which will happen hopefully shortly after that.
And so just based on that what you just said and what level of participation I've had in the property measurement standard group as well. It seems as though we're following a similar path now in terms of outreach and getting more people engaged. And I don't know exactly about the time frame, if it's that's pretty much the same or not, but any of these things that you're doing, obviously, being international, are not going to happen overnight.
No, although, you know, it's not just me sitting here. I should point it out. This is not an RICS project. You know, as you know, this is a full coalition project. We're all equal partners on this. And, you know, for instance, one of the organizations is the international organization called FIABSI, which some of your members will have heard of. Now, they have already introduced, for instance, the International Rights of Way Association from the U.S. and the... What's the other one? The Lebanese Syndicate of Real Estate Associations. So the actual members themselves are now going out there and getting additional membership. So they're coming in every day, and I think it will be different to the property measurement standards, Kurt, because property measurement, it's technical. It's going to appeal only to those who really, really are having to deal with that day in, day out. Ethics, although a little bit more sort of conceptual, if you like, at the top, which brings its own problems, does apply to everything we touch, everything we do. So, you know, we've already agreed as a group that we want to be as inclusive as possible, and therefore we've said that membership of the coalition is open to not just the property industry, but related industries as well. And that's throwing up some interesting discussions at the moment, I think, and this can be a question of how wide do we want this to go. But I think the very fact that so many organizations from so many different countries around the world, the fact that they are showing interest so quickly, I think indicates that we were all right, that there is a demand for these overarching standards. And, of course, there are some areas, Kurt, as you'll be aware, some countries where, you know, they're not even got proper ethical standards. So there's it's very, very different when you're dealing with a mature market like the UK or the USA compared with some of the developing markets. It's a very different scenario, which comes with its own issues, of course.
Yes, and that's a very interesting aspect, I think, of what's going on. When you were talking about the variety of entities and variety of activities that are covered by the people in those entities who are interested in this, because as you pointed out, each of us, dependent on what piece of the work we do or what we're licensed to do or how we operate, are likely going to have some perspective on what ethical behavior should be, at least from other people toward us and hopefully from us toward them. So I think it's a good idea to get as much input as possible.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, of course, as you and I come across, what you and I would agree sometimes is unethical behavior in some parts and some countries, some parts of the world, is counted as normal business practice. So it's going to be quite interesting as the debate moves forward as to, well, who actually agrees what's right and who what's wrong and who's actually right and wrong. And I say one of the problems is also going to be, I think, that there are occasions when ethical behavior doesn't necessarily fall in line with making them as much money as you can for your shareholders, dare I say. So, you know, I think it's going to be some interesting debates as we move forward.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And even in practice myself all through the years and realizing that no matter where we live, we're global now to some degree. And so having had some experience in that, I've actually encountered some of the things you're talking about, where what I might consider certainly not something that I would see as ethical behavior was a way of doing business to somebody else. And so it always creates an interesting dynamic when you're having discussions with people and to figure out what one person is going to do, what the other is going to do, and what your responsibilities are. So clearly I can see that will be a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, and again, it was one of our colleagues who met in when we met in New York, actually, was saying she actually is from Germany and looks after the management side of Nancy Kirk, actually, from IREM, Residential Managers. And she pointed out that property managers themselves are really affected by globalization. I don't think they've realized this at times, because as she pointed out, tenants come from all over the world these days, whether it be for commercial or residential. Capital certainly comes from all over the world. Building owners come from all over the world. And therefore, you know, all of our members are more and more involved in multinational companies and have to be attuned to what's going on in that company throughout the world, not just that company is registered in their hometown. So, no, there are. It's going to be very, very interesting that you could be dealing with the same company in different parts of the world, yet their business practices perhaps are slightly different.
Yes, that is certainly going to be of interest. And we've got 3 minutes or so left in this segment. And one of the things I want to do as we get to the next segment, and we can continue to talk about the standards for the rest of the segment if you wish, but I know one of the things our listeners are going to be interested in is what's happening in the UK now with your market and how things are going, and because then we'll have something to make comparison, because we sort of know where we are. So I want to get to that, and we certainly will in the next segment. But if you want to begin that now, that's okay too.
No, I mean, I think it's interesting, Kurt, that you'll have to shut me up when we go to the break. But, you know, we often say over here, whatever happens in America tends to happen over here a bit later. It's quite interesting, actually, that the one exception to that appears to have been sort of what has happened post the financial crash, if you like, with the property market. Because for various reasons, we haven't seen some of the dramatic issues and problems and falls in property prices that some parts of the U.S. have found. And I know it's not good to see that your median prices are picking up in a number of areas. But, yeah, it's interesting to perhaps just have a chat about what's happening in the U.K. and what's likely to happen sort of as we move forward, because we have a general election coming up in May next year. Goodness only knows who's going to win that. It seems to be all over the place in the polls at the moment. And that in itself will give a little bit of a nervousness to the market, no doubt, as we get to May next year.
Yeah, we all are affected by those elections, whether they're, at least for us, whether they're local or state or federal or whatever the case may be. And I know we're going to talk about some of that aspect of things, because having been involved in local government, at least from a being on a planning commission side, not as a government employee or official, recognizing all of those factors that come into play when we start talking about what drives the market and what keeps it going, and people's different perspectives on what should occur and what should not occur with regard to how land is developed and how it's used and kind of thing. So I know we're going to talk about that some when we get back as well.
The advantage I've got is that at least we only have a few months to talk about the election, not the years that you guys have. But
yeah, it seems as though here it's gotten to the point where we have a continual election cycle. We never seem to have any break. It just goes from one right to the next, and as soon as one election is over, just as we've had here, and fairly significant change, at least on the federal level. Now all of a sudden we're talking about what's going to happen in 2 more years or 4 more years or whatever the case may be. So yeah, it does get very interesting in the politics and how things are perceived, and then of course everything eventually boils down to that local level. So when we come back, I want to have a conversation with you about that. So let's go to break and we will be right back.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our last segment today with Peter Bolton King, and again, thank you for being with me. We had a really good conversation, I think, about international standards. We certainly talked about the way things work in our two countries to some degree. And just before we went to break, we had begun to talk about the whole concept of how things happen, what's happening in the market, how the markets are changing. And one of the things you mentioned to me when we were in our previous conversation that I found to be really interesting was the whole owner versus occupier dynamic that seems to be occurring in England. And I don't know that I have a response to that in terms of here in the U.S., because here it always seems to be everybody wants to own a little piece of land somewhere. Mm-hmm. Although at the same time, while that's going on, the occupier-renter population seems to be growing as well. So, but I'm interested in what's happening there and what your perspectives are on that.
Yeah, there's some interesting things going on over here, actually. You'd be glad to know, did a quick calculation, because I thought that your listeners might be interested to know average prices over here. So I've just changed it into dollars. Across the whole of the UK, the average house price at the moment is about $286,000. That's the average one. In London, however, the average price is about $600,000. So as you understand, living in London is very, very difficult and almost impossible for your poor old first-time buyer. And people trying to get onto the ladder, but we have this big question and debate over here continually as to whether property is overvalued, whether it is affordable. And yeah, you're right, Kurt. There has been a fundamental change over the last 10, 20, 15 years, I suppose, in this whole question of owner-occupier and renting a property. Now, there's two reasons for that, or several reasons for that. We, at the end of the day, generally, like you in the UK, if you ask everybody, even the youngsters, would they like to own their own property, the answer for the vast, vast majority would be yes. The problem has been that for many of them, that is almost becoming an impossible dream because of the affordability. And that's before the tightening up on the ability to get a mortgage has occurred over the last few years, because we've had some European directives on how much you should be on the way that lenders are lending, the checks they should be carrying out. Absolutely quite right to make sure that people can afford the mortgage, but that is having an impact. So what has happened over the years, over the last few years, is that the percentage of those who were in owner occupation, who own their own property with or without a loan, is slowly but surely now dropping a little bit. It's still very high, but it is dropping a bit. What we've seen a massive growth in, though, is the private rented sector, those who are renting the property. And at the moment, that is about 18%, 19% of all households live in the private rented sector. And I reckon that I'm not sure by the end of this decade, but certainly by the next, we probably could have 25%, a quarter of all households being in the private rented sector. Now, some of those people want to be in that sector because they don't like the idea of having a mortgage around their neck. They're not confident that prices are going to keep going up. They want the flexibility to be able to move around the country with work or indeed around Europe, increasingly the world. Others are, if you like, reluctant, e.g. they can't afford a property, therefore they have been forced into the private rented sector as the tenure of last resort. But there has been this fundamental shift that you've alluded to, and certainly renting a property is in no shape or form the social stigma that it perhaps was back in the 1970s. So there is that fundamental shift. But we were talking earlier about these prices, Kurt, and I was saying that, you know, the perhaps slightly difference between the USA and the UK, because if we look at average prices from a peak of the pre-financial crash, we're actually seeing on average they're about 6.5% above that level. Now, that's not everywhere around the country, and poor old Northern Ireland suffered quite badly. They're probably still running at about 40% below the peak, so they're still way down, but on average 6.5%. The exception to the rule being London. London, even since that peak following the before the crash, has gone up by 31.6%. Just hasn't stopped. It's just kept going and going and going, which, as I said earlier, brings its problems. So, you know, we haven't seen these massive price falls that other places have seen. Even Spain, for instance, has seen. Why? And I think it comes down to a straightforward supply and demand situation. We are a small island. People are very, very precious about the green land around the urban areas. We have a thing called the green belt around those urban areas, which really there's a presumption against development in those areas. That in itself means that instead of building the 225,000-250,000 new properties that we need to build a year, and that's on top of the deficit we've already got, we're actually building nothing like that. We only, I think, last year built about 128,000. So we have a supply-demand gap. That is exacerbated in the south of the country, London and the southeast, where it's a more tighter urban area. We've got to find ways of being able to not only build more properties, but also being able to build more affordable properties for people. And that is causing a lot of problems. People know that there needs to be new property. They know that they've got to have them around themselves. They know they've got to have it in little towns and villages if they are going to retain local shops, schools, etc. But of course, as I know you have in the USA, because we've talked about it before, we've still got this problem of a lot of people saying, well, yeah, fine, but don't build it anywhere near me. Or as you said to me the other day, Kurt, I think banana.
Right, yeah, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything.
Yep.
That seems to be prevalent in some areas. And I guess just from the perspective of someone sitting where I sit and thinking about England, is there an issue with developable land or just an issue with the access to developable land?
It's a mixture, actually. There is developable land out there. There are brownfield sites. There are sites which, and the problem with some of these sites is that they are expensive to develop. The actual infrastructure costs are probably quite high. They're not necessarily going to be the highest value properties. So there's a big debate going on as to, you know, what can central government, what can local government do to encourage development on those redevelopment sites without necessarily having to sprawl out into the countryside, although I think this green belt policy I mentioned earlier needs to be looked at. So it is a mixture of things, and no, central government have recently in the UK devolved power much more back to those local authorities to try and sort this out. All local authorities now have to come up with a plan to show where their supply of housing is coming from in the next 5 years. Unfortunately, only about 50% have actually produced that plan so far. So it's a mixture of issues. There's no one thing. And as I say, one of the big problems, Kurt, is we've got this situation where, because London is so powerful from an economic point of view, that, of course, is where there's an awful lot of the growth required, and that's where there isn't the land to develop. So perhaps we have to go up again.
Right, yeah. And as I think about that, I think about what we refer to as the bedroom communities, where you build places where people live relatively near where work is available, but they don't really develop too much into their own entity, so to speak. They're just a place where people live, and there's some goods and services associated with it. And what tends to happen, though, is that as that starts to grow, then everything else starts to grow. So you have these little pockets all over the place of high development and availability of the services that are not necessarily tied to your metropolitan areas.
Yeah, well, there again is another issue. You know, these services, the infrastructure needs to go in to support these developments, but of course nobody wants to pay for it. The local authority don't, the developers don't, central government say we ain't got any money. So there are a number of issues, very, very similar to what you're talking about, but there's a number of issues over here that we're trying to address at the moment.
Right. And then if you start talking about the ability to build or the desire to build, is there any kind of a materials shortage, or is materials ample?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I probably shouldn't say this, but I remember talking to one of our previous people, called it's a housing minister over here we had, and I was talking to her some years ago, and she said, when things were quite quiet, she said, well, the important thing, Peter, is that the building industry are able to turn the tap on again when the market picks up. And I looked at her, and I stared at her, and I said, Minister, last time this happened, the builders will tell you it took 10 years to get the skill base back in. And she went, oh. And this is one of the issues. It is cropping up, actually. Last year, when things did start picking up and there was the increased demand and the builders were beginning to start bringing their sites on tap, all of a sudden, we've got a skills shortage. We've also got a materials shortage in some things. For instance, I know a number of brick manufacturers which had sort of mothballed their factories have come back out into production again. But we're having to import certain products that are ridiculous, really, not exactly a good carbon footprint when you have to import materials that should be produced over here. So skill shortage is becoming a major issue.
Yeah, we're seeing that too, and it seems as though there's this concept that sort of a generalized thing, and obviously not everywhere, but it's almost as though those well-paying jobs that require skills somehow aren't viewed as important as some of the other more exciting jobs that some people look at, you know, the computerization, all that kind of thing. But without the skilled jobs, you still can't get anything done. And it seems to me that here there's been less emphasis on driving people toward those skilled jobs.
You're right, and probably like me, it's not exactly easy to get a local plumber to come in and do a little job.
That's very true.
I'm in the wrong business. I tell you, just I know we're running out of time, Kerb. I was going to say one of the other things we've found is that the market picked up last year, and we're going to have about 1.1 million transactions during 2014. So, you know, the market's not tiny. For a small country, that's quite a lot of them. But what we have found is that there has actually become to be a shortage of valuers out here, not necessarily the valuers themselves, but their desire to get involved in secured lending valuations when, in their mind, they're not paid enough to do it, and the risks of being sued and the cost of insurance over here actually doesn't make it worthwhile. So we've got a bit of a balance which is wrong at the moment on risk and reward in the industry, which is something that the RICS are busy working with the industry to try and overcome that. So some interesting dynamics there on that.
Oh, absolutely. That's a sector of the profession that you need, and if people don't see it as advantageous, then it's a problem. And so, well, we've got 25 seconds left, so I don't forget to do this. I do want to thank you for being with me, Peter. It's been a fantastic show. I know our listeners will have gained a lot from having you on the show, and I really appreciate it.
Kurt, it's a pleasure, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Look forward to talking with you again soon on our standards group.
Indeed. Goodbye.
Take care.
Happy Christmas, Kurt, and everybody.
And to you too.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.